Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show, I think these are great wintertime topics because they're plants that they're plant experiences that we can have indoors.
Exactly.
How's that?
Perfect.
It's perfect. Yep. We're going to talk to Richard Rivas. He co-owns the Black Jungle Terrarium Supply Company up in Massachusetts.
Where else?
Richard basically knows terrariums front to back, and we'll talk about what you need to do to create a successful terrarium, and then the different little critters that you can put in it too.
Yep.
And one of the things that they do, they sell, have a pretty large collection of poison dart frogs, and they are ideal for terrarium life because they're from the tropics. But part of what's important about this is some of the frogs that in their native habitat are struggling, you know, or endangered, or going on extinct, and they are able to help with conservation methods as well because they raise the frogs in-house, if you will, in Massachusetts themselves.
Would that be a good gift for your mother-in-law for Christmas? A poison dart frog?
I would say it depends on your mother-in-law.
I've got a great one, folks.
Okay. Well, and these aren't really poisonous once you have them here.
I know. Yeah.
So yes, it would be a nice gift, I think.
I may mail you one then, Miss Wishy.
I think I might need to try the terrarium thing again. I had one as a kid.
Yeah,
but, you know,
I tried it too. And
bombed.
Well, I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah, we'll pay attention this time.
I will.
All right, and Kevin Williams and the Kintia palm.
Yeah, interesting. It's the palm tree I'm sure we see in hotels and lobbies and some homes around the whole country, really.
Yeah.
And the whole thing began in the South Pacific Islands, Lord Howe Island, and then there's Norfolk Island, which, of course, is where the Norfolk Island pine also came from. And they're kind of at a junction. They're 600 miles from New Zealand and Australia down in the South Pacific, these kind of lost little lands that somehow now export Kintia palm seeds, millions of them.
Millions of them,
all over the world. And exactly how this happened is a very interesting story.
And it is. It was like an exchange of sorts. The Norfolk Island pine came from Norfolk Island.
Right.
And then the palm came from Lord Howe Island.
Yep.
And between two people that were sort of plant hunters, exchanged seeds to each island. And then so it becomes Norfolk Island being like this major palm producer today.
Yep, the rest is history.
The rest is history.
All over the world. So it's a great story. He wrote a book called Seed to Elegance, which is interesting and worth reading.
That's right. And if you want a houseplant, that's the plant for you, apparently. Super easy to grow. All right, Bob, what's going on in your garden?
I've been trying this fall, depending on the weather, and it depends on, the week, of course. I've been digging up my old daffodils and moving them. For years, I threatened to do that, to remember where I put the patches the spring before, and I finally got to it, and I dug them up, and they are so thick in there. They're like a brain. So they really, really needed it badly. So I've just been doing that. There's hundreds, if not thousands, of them cramped in there. And I'm moving them around and kind of scattering them around and trying to sight them. So my first mistake I made. So after 6 weeks, you can let the green come up and not cut it down right away. It doesn't get in the way of the rest of what you're doing.
Right.
It's tricky.
Forward thinking.
Yeah, because if you naturalize them too much in the grass, then you can't mow for a long time. So I'm redistributing my daffodils, and they are happy, and I'm happy.
Right, good.
How about you? What's up?
I have been cleaning up the brambles in the garden and working on the asparagus bed because, you know, once the asparagus ferns start to yellow and brown out, the plant's finished using it, so you can clean it up. And it actually is a good idea to go ahead and clean it up now and not wait too long because if you have problems with the asparagus beetle, you know, it'll overwinter in that debris. So if you can get that cleaned up now and get it out in a way, you're one way to control the asparagus beetle. And then for blackberries and raspberries, especially those that are when it concerns raspberries, Bob, you got to know what kind of raspberries you're growing.
Yeah.
You know whether they're ever bearing or just that June bearing.
And we want to keep you in raspberries because it's important to me to keep you in
raspberries. Exactly. We grow the ever bearing varieties, which have two harvests, but we forgo that first harvest in the early summer.
Oh.
Because we go ahead and cut all the canes down to the ground.
There you go.
Mostly to control disease problems.
Ah.
If we don't, then we usually have a higher incidence of like doubles and other weird sort of disease problems. So go ahead and cut your raspberry canes back. Blackberry canes, cut back any canes that fruited this year and then reserve the canes that grew this year because that's what's going to fruit for you next year.
Now, they keep spreading. I know at some point you have to get in there and just whack them way back and dig around them and thin them out. Or
I usually try to keep, I don't let them spread too much. I usually cut those, the suckers that come out too far from the main part of the plant just to keep them
under control. Can you use your lawnmower and just go, "Hum"?
For real young ones, yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. But not, you can't maintain it that way.
Right.
Because with the blackberries, you can't, because you're still going to have to make sure you leave those canes that grew this year, or else you'll have no fruit ever. Yeah. But with the raspberries, it's probably best to do it by hand. Okay. Yeah.
Because I'm a John Deere pruner from time to time.
But I mean, but the stuff that goes out of the intended bed, yeah, you can mow that down, you know, so don't worry about that. But yeah, now's the time to get that stuff cleaned up, and it'll go a good deal in terms of controlling some pest problems as well.
And keep Bob and Burry's next to you.
Exactly. Exactly. All right, now on to the Kentia palm.
Yeah, I'm thinking of growing some in Indiana, which may be a problem, at least outdoors. But if I wanted to do it, we've got the guy to help us out. His name's Kevin Williams. He's a Kentia palm grower and broker who has a lifelong passion for the plant. He lived on Norfolk Island in the South Pacific for 30 years, a tiny 3-by-5-mile island that's produced millions of seeds and trees for world production. He now lives in Southfield, Michigan, and has written a book about his passion called Seed to Elegance, the Kentia Palms of Norfolk Island in the South Pacific. Kevin, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Yeah, before we get into your personal history, let's talk some about the palm tree itself, the Kentia Palm. Describe the tree itself. What's it like and how big does it get? And so our listeners know what we're talking about here.
Right. The Kentia grows from seed, and it takes about 12 months for it to germinate. It will then take probably about another 4 or 5 years before it becomes a height of a saleable item.
And then what makes it so popular as a... I assume it's a tree you see in hotel lobbies and houses.
It's popular because it doesn't need any maintenance, and it likes the indoor conditions. It can stand up to the humidity, the air conditioning, and one of the reasons it was popular in England in those days, they had those, you know, for heating, they had fireplaces, and it adapted quite well inside those dark buildings, yes.
So its native environment, though, what was the climate like?
The climate on Lord Howe Island, where it... lives outside, grows outside, grows outside on Lord Howe, Norfolk, the east coast of Australia, probably the northern part of New Zealand, where the temperatures don't get below, say, 42 Fahrenheit for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So that's what it's used to outside.
Okay. Does it require decent amounts of water or, you know, exceptionally good drainage, that sort of thing?
It's an easy plant to grow because it doesn't need a lot of maintenance. What you can do is you can just give it a cup of water a week, that'll suffice. It's very slow growing. I've got one here in my home now. A new spike only comes out about once every 4 to 6 months.
Mm-hmm. So, Kevin, are there more than one species? Because in the book, Seed to Elegance, where you address the Kentia palm, there are some, you know, what Bob was referencing, those that we're sort of familiar with that we see in hotel lobbies or in, you know, somebody's sunny big room, you know, very leafy, if you will. But then some of them are more of that kind of traditional palm tree with, you know, a trunk and then the fronds at the top. Are those two different types of Kentia palms?
There's two kind of palms. The Kentia, it's the Howie Fosteriana and the Belmoreana.
Mm-hmm.
Belmoreana takes a lot longer to grow, and I think it's called the curly palm, and it has the fronds canopy more down.
Okay.
Well, was this thing originally only growing on Lord Howe Island to begin with?
Correct, yes.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it?
It is amazing, and it went from, it was only like a handful of seed went to Norfolk, as I say in the book, how the guy from New Zealand who went to Norfolk, he took that Araucaria seed, the Norfolk Island pine, and took it back to Lord Howe. So Lord Howe has got Norfolk Island pines growing along the foreshore, but the whole island's covered in Kentias.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
So that was the swap. One place gets the Norfolk Island pine, the other gets the Kentia palm.
Correct.
And so the Norfolk Island pine, just for a brief diversion, because we're familiar with that too, that began on Norfolk Island also?
That's right. It's called the Araucaria heterophylla.
Uh-huh.
And when Captain Cook went there in 1774, he noticed that the island was full of Norfolk Island pine, and it's known as the native pine. And I gather that he took some seed got to Hawaii, and it cross-pollinated with a palm there, and that's the Excelsior that you see here in the United States. Mm-hmm. They use it for Christmas trees and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, how far apart are Lord Howe Island and Norfolk Island?
Lord Howe's 600 miles east of Sydney, and Norfolk's another 600 miles further east.
It just amazes me that each island produced a very separate and unique plant unto themselves and the whole world.
It's amazing, yes. Yeah.
Kind of neat.
Norfolk's on a volcanic ridge that comes up from New Zealand, and that's how it it developed. Lord Howe, I think the Great Barrier Reef goes almost out to Lord Howe Island.
Huh. Well, the island's certainly known for the Kentia palm now, and it has become a bit of an industry for the island. Is that correct?
Correct. Correct. Okay. What happened was that back in the early 70s, most of the seed that was being sold in the world came from Lord Howe Island. But what Lord Howe Island decided to do was to not export any seed, then just to grow seedlings and sell the seedlings. And, of course, that was a better income for them. Mm-hmm. So then the European growers didn't want to pay the extra, so they were looking for somewhere else that was producing the seed, and Norfolk had just started. So they turned to Norfolk, and the demand escalated, so people decided to start planting Kentias on their properties, mm-hmm. and because they were getting paid for the seed. And I think in the 70s it was like they were getting $60 a bushel, and then when the demand went up in the 80s, they were getting $1,050 a bushel.
Wow. Mm.
So, okay, the Kentia palm's pretty available in that mass market sort of way, Kevin, but we can go back, you know, from the 1970s, we can go back 100 years, and that's sort of where it started in terms of other people being interested in it on the Victorian era. But there was a little more prestige attached to owning one. Can you talk a little bit about the historical past of the and popularity of the Kentia palm?
Well, I think the lady that really pushed the popularity was Queen Victoria. And as the book shows, there are a number of photographs where she had the Kentia in her castles and other areas or buildings that she owned. And when they saw that, people thought, oh, this is a great plant. Mm-hmm. You know, if Queen Victoria's got it, then I should have.
And then when she died, I understand it was called the Century Palm because it was posted at all four corners of her casket.
Right, that's another name for it now. Yeah, called the Century Palm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a sense of how many Kentia palms are planted each year or sold each year around the world?
Around the world, well, as I say, that guy in Sicily, he imports 5 million seedlings from from Norfolk each year. So he ships them into Belgium. They truck them down to Sicily, and then he grows them. And then once they're big enough, and they ship them back up right throughout Europe. I would say probably Kentia has produced 5 million a year.
Wow. So it seems like the seed of the Kentia palm is what most people are after eventually. Can you talk a little bit about how long it takes for this for seed production to actually occur, and then the harvesting of the seed and, you know, how it's dispersed? You know, why is it such big business?
It takes 15 years for a tree to produce its first crop of seed. Mm-hmm. And the first crop of seed, how we pick it is the trees are usually the mature trees. Sometimes they're 20, 30 feet tall. Mm-hmm. We have to use an extension ladder. We climb the tree, pull the fronds off, and then throw them down into a hessian bag, and then we stomp off the seed from the fronds. We dry it out for about 2 weeks, then we just go ahead and plant it, and then we wait until it starts to germinate, check out what numbers are available there, then we start to harvest them just by hand. Mm-hmm. And you can harvest seedlings if at a fast rate, maybe about 800 an hour, and then you just pull them out with your hand. They must have the nut on them because the nut's got enough nutrition in that small seedling for almost 15 months to help it develop. So in the early stages of when you transplant them, they don't need fertilization.
Mm-hmm. Are there any natural enemies or friends of them, like predators, birds eat the seeds on you?
Rats. And what you have on the trees down there, because people have them on their properties and they're paid for the seeds, so it's like there's no social security or anything like that on the island. It's a tax-free island. So what people do to protect their investment is they make what they call a tin hat around the trunk, and that stops the rats from climbing up and getting to the seed.
Okay, and talk some about the American production market of Kentia seed, including apparently in Michigan.
I was growing Kentias up in Michigan, similar to the way the Europeans grow them. There are not a lot of Kentia producers in the United States. They would prefer to bring their own seedlings in so that what happens there is if they're buying the seed, it's already germinated, so they're 15 months more advanced from what they had to do by planting seed. Okay. And the seed in California, they don't get a very good viability rate on it. On Norfolk, if you plant, and Lord Howe, if you plant Kentia seeds, you get about 75 to 80% germination. I think here in the United States, it'd be 28 or 30.
Wow.
How long will they live?
You shouldn't have any problems with them. If you just water them and follow the instructions on... they don't get any direct sunlight inside. That's the main thing. They'll last for a long, long time.
Will they go through the living room ceiling eventually?
No. Because if they're only throwing out one spike every 4 to 6 months, it's going to take quite a long time. What they do is they canopy a lot. Instead of having the height, you're going to get probably the width.
Mm-hmm. And Sounds good. One last question. Is the market growing? What's the future of the Kentia palm?
Looks like it's picking up in Europe. I know a friend of mine on Norfolk just planted 750 bushels, which is nearly 4 million seeds for one customer, or seedlings for one customer in Europe. But it takes a lot of marketing here in the United States because they just haven't been readily available to home consumers. That's my goal. I mean, I just love Kentias, and I think, every home should have one because they're... a terrific plant in these economic downturns because they last so long. You don't throw them away every 3 or 4 months.
Right. Well, Kevin, thank you. Enjoy talking to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Williams is a Kentia palm grower and broker who has a lifelong passion for the plant and wrote a book about it called Seed to Elegance. For more information on Kevin or the Kentia palm, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
After the break, Richard Rivas helps us create a perfect microclimate for tropical plants and animals using terrariums. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And I'm Bob Hill, who once tried a terrarium.
Did you? I once tried a terrarium, too.
Yeah. I naturally ran out of patience after about 3 or 4 months, but it was kind of fun to have this little... all this little world in there, like shipping a bottle kind of thing.
Exactly. And I recall, because this was when I was really young, I recall that most of the plants were plastic, however, in my terrarium. Like remnants of stuff that Daddy had from like a fish tank or something like that, you know? So I'm excited to learn a little bit more about how to actually grow a real one with real plants in it. I would be shamed out of most of my jobs if I maintained a plastic plant terrarium these days, don't you think?
That's kind of feeling. Yeah, mine, the opposite. I think I had one plant that took over and just blocked everything else out.
Did you put plant kudzu in it or something?
I think it was. Some kind of vine, I think it was.
Okay.
It was a good idea for about 2 weeks.
Right. Well, here's a really good idea. Pay attention to this one, okay?
Okay.
But Richard Rivas is joining us now. He's the co-owner of Black Jungle Terrarium Supply Company in Turner Falls, Massachusetts. They grow various unusual tropical plants, maintain a collection of poison dart frogs. You need a poison dart frog, Bob.
I got several.
And everything else that's needed to set up a natural terrarium. Richard's traveled in Costa Rica, Panama, Puerto Rico, and the United Kingdom in order to learn more about providing the most naturalistic terraria he possibly can. Richard, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Great. How did you get interested in terrariums?
Well, basically, when I was a little kid growing up, actually out in the desert southwest, I had always been fascinated by just the little bits of life you would see along the washes and wherever there was any small amount of water trickling through the desert. It was a bit frustrating because as fascinated as I always was with different amphibians and plants and things, out there, I basically had to do everything inside. There wasn't much of an opportunity to go out and see things growing in the wild, so I started keeping aquariums and then terrariums with small frogs and other little amphibians pretty early on.
Wow. So if we look at, I guess, the fascination with terrariums, the ability, as you say, you know, you couldn't really access it so much or easily where you were living, so you kind of created this own environment yourself. Is there some sort of, you know, long history to people sort of containing these types of things in terrariums? Is it something that people did, you know, 1,000 years ago, or is it something that has a little bit more of a recent past?
Well, relatively recently. It was back in the 1800s when he was actually a physician by the name of Dr. Ward. He was very interested in the growing of tropical plants and had always struggled keeping things alive in his studio, and then realized that one day that the plants that were growing in small little specimen jars and that sort of thing throughout his lab seemed to be thriving. And so he soon started experimenting, having some cases made with glazed glass and trying plants growing in there, and all of a sudden the plants thrived. So after a while, those cases, which later became known as the Wardian case, were instrumental actually in a wide range of fields of botany, but especially just from the perspective of allowing people to grow plants that normally would not be suited for their particular climate. Right in their own homes, living rooms, that sort of thing.
So the Wardian case is sort of the first terrarium then?
Exactly.
Huh.
Some of them actually were quite elaborate, even using little coal-fired stoves to provide heat.
Wow.
They were frequently installed on ships, on ocean voyages, enabling people to bring back plants from other countries that normally just never would have been able to survive the trip.
Is there much interest compared to other European countries in terms of having terrariums and collecting little animals, amphibians, and tropical plants?
Well, there's quite a bit of a progression that the terrarium went through first, in that, you know, back in the 1800s, the terrarium typically was something that was only owned by people that were in the upper class, wealthy people who could afford such things. Over the following decades and into the 20th century, it wasn't until probably the late 1950s, early 1960s, that the terrarium, as most Americans are familiar with it, really started becoming popular. And a lot of that did have to do with the mass production use of plastics and even glassware, but at that point it was still pretty much a plant-only type of enclosure. In Europe, things, probably because they had access to more of these containers for longer periods of time, actually took on a little bit more of a diverse twist, in that people then started actually using it to keep a variety of different rare and exotic animals as well. Probably one of the most notable animals kept in the terrarium are the amphibians, especially because they do require typically much more humid, more wet conditions, and especially with certain small tropical American species commonly known as poison dart frogs.
All right, we'll get to that in a little bit. I want to hear about these poison dart frogs. So can I guess, before we step into what the components of a successful terrarium are, How do you define terrarium?
Well, a terrarium, in its most basic sense, would be any sort of enclosed container that is designed to help support life where perhaps life would not be as easily supported without it. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily 100% contained. A lot of it really depends on what you're growing in there. And the definition has relaxed quite a bit, but generally it is an enclosed container to one degree or another used to help grow at least plants.
So that would include, like, I had a big water bottle I used at one time. That's a terrarium.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. A lot of different containers have been used over the years. The large water containers are one, different apothecary jars, all sorts of just different decorative containers.
Does size matter at all? You know, is there a maximum size? Like, are you still a terrarium if you can walk inside of it?
No, probably then you'd cross over into atrium.
Okay, or conservatory or something, right?
Or Hawaii.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. But on the other end, it's amazing how beautiful the tiniest of little glass vessels can be with something just as simple as a little pad of moss.
Yeah.
It's not even anything that requires any amount of, you know, you don't have to be growing anything elaborate, blooming, flowering, mm-hmm. anything like that. You can just have something very simple.
Yeah, I can see how that would be great. What are the components of a terrarium? If Bob and I want to start a terrarium at home, what are the supplies that we're going to need to get started?
Well, really, there are two main basic elements. One is the drainage layer. And this obviously is important because you don't want water collecting down in the bottom of the container to where it's pooling around the plant's roots and potentially rotting them. Traditionally, people have used aquarium gravel, although nowadays there are different products that tend to work out a little bit better. Something that provides a little bit better drainage is more porous, lightweight in the form of clay pellets.
Mm-hmm.
The second layer then is the actual planting substrate. And the planting substrate can, in the most basic terrariums, be something as simple as a high-quality potting soil. Depending on the longevity of the terrarium you're looking for and the specific types of conditions, that may need to be modified into some of the newer types of growing mediums based on the ground coconut fiber. Commonly called COIR, COIR.
Mm-hmm.
That product is definitely far longer lasting than any of the potting soils and has a lot of good water holding capabilities while still providing lots of aeration to the soil.
Mm-hmm.
The third aspect then to keep in mind is what sort of layout you want to have in the terrarium as far as decorative pieces of wood. Not all pieces of wood are suitable for the terrarium, especially in more enclosed ones as they can rot quickly or support large amounts of mold or fungal growth.
So, and I guess, too, it would matter if you were going to have some sort of amphibian in there or not, because it would need somewhere to perch or hide or
exactly.
Whatever.
When you're setting up an enclosure that is going to house a living animal as well, the most important thing is to research what the conditions are needed by the animal and then build the terrarium around it.
Okay.
Or at least furnish the terrarium around it.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes we have customers who, you know, want to or actually will assemble their terrarium first and wind up with, you know, plants X, Y, and Z, and have a certain humidity level, certain light levels, and then say, okay, this is the animal I want to keep, and it's just completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is to definitely make sure that you know the needs of the animal you're looking at keeping, and then choose the plants and other surroundings that are appropriate for it.
Richard, is there a general range of light and humidity and temperature that works best for terrariums? Just for plants now, not for animals.
Well, the majority of the plants that are housed in terrariums are considered tropicals. So you're looking at temperatures generally at least in the upper 60s to maybe up into the 80s. Light levels have, again, depending on the species that you're going with, the light levels typically tend to be somewhat bright to lower light levels. It's difficult to provide very bright light to a terrarium, especially a closed one, without potentially overheating the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Even a focal heat source from a plant light bulb can actually overheat leaf surface temperatures if there's not enough air circulation around the plant. And air circulation is typically not something that you really have too much of in the terrarium.
Okay, in the perfect terrarium, closed one, can it be self-contained for months and years without opening the top at all, just produces its own oxygen and water and... Talk about that
exactly.
A little bit.
Exactly. And that's one of the miraculous things about them is they, when they are designed properly and the appropriate plants are used, namely ones that just are not going to require really any type of pruning or trimming to stay in shape and stay contained, you can have a completely closed environment that, you know, perhaps maybe at the most once or twice a year, you may have to apply a little bit of water to it. But for the most part, they're very self-contained,
wow.
And it becomes a small living world.
Hmm. Do you recommend a natural light source or an artificial light source?
It depends on the plants that you're growing. A lot of plants will do very well just with an indirect light source from, say, next to a window where there's no direct sun actually hitting it, but it's still bright enough to support them.
Mm-hmm.
Other plants, especially most blooming species, do require more intense lighting than what you would be able to safely provide via natural lighting coming in through a window. And in those cases, fluorescent lighting is definitely the best way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Incandescent bulbs, even ones that are designed for use with plant growth, tend to still have the potential to overheat the terrarium, whereas the fluorescents, especially the new compact fluorescent bulbs that save a lot of electricity, also put out a lot of light with very little heat.
So can you give us some plants... you know, some of those easy ones
right.
to start off with.
Yeah, the Bob and Jeanine plants.
Yeah, the Bob and Jeanine plants for the terrarium. What would you suggest to start out with? You know, we always want to be met with success, not failure, when we start something new. So what's the easiest to start off with in terms of plants?
Well, I think probably some of the best to begin with are especially plants from the fern family. And the family of ferns is just truly massive. There's so many different varieties and growth habits out there. But for the terrarium keeper, probably some of the smaller growing ferns, like say the rabbit's foot fern,
mm-hmm.
Especially the black rabbit's foot fern. That one has very nice, finely dissected fronds, but the fronds are also a little bit thicker in texture, and a thicker leaf typically has a little bit greater tolerance to conditions that will fluctuate a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
They'll also be a little bit more tolerant of any type of excessive moisture, so they're not going to be as prone to rotting. Other good fern allies that will work out well in there include selaginellas. And selaginellas are also sometimes known as club mosses.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few hardy species, but many, many tropical ones, some of which can be an iridescent purple-blue,
wow.
such as the selaginella uncinata.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a beautiful species known as the blood red selaginella that has deep, deep cherry red undersides
mm-hmm.
with a dark, dark forest green surface to the frond.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another one that does actually very well under very low light levels.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other creeping selaginellas, like the Krausiana that comes in several varieties, all of those do very well in the terrarium and require minimal trimming to really keep them in shape.
You mentioned trimming. Are specific tools needed to get inside there and prune and pluck and move things around?
Sometimes there are. It depends on the container that you use. Obviously, containers that have a larger opening on the top make it much easier to plant the terrarium and also maintain things. Whereas in the more constricted necked containers, such as the large water containers, special tools are required, and those tools actually are fairly easily accessible through most garden centers, or especially mail order suppliers will carry the tools that will allow you to do that.
And then watering itself, I mean, is death nature's way of telling you overwatered your terrarium? how do you know?
That's one way of looking at it, but hopefully that's not the way most people do it.
Right.
It'll keep you in business, though,
really,
right?
In the terrarium, you're looking for a moist but still very well-drained and very porous substrate. So you don't really want to see water pooled anywhere except for perhaps in the very bottom drainage area of the or drainage layer of the terrarium. Under most cases, the better rule of thumb is to water too little than too much. Mm-hmm. Many plants, especially even if they reach a very minor stage of wilt, can be brought back easily just by giving them a drink, whereas once they start rotting, especially in the terrarium, it can spread quickly and wipe the whole thing out.
And then roughly, what would it cost me to get started with a basic terrarium and a few plants and some success?
Well, that's one of the great things about the terrariums is that the cost to set something like this up can vary tremendously and can fit the budgets of almost anybody. You know, starting with something as simple as even an old glass container or old fishbowl that you might have around the house, it's really just a matter of maybe $20-$30 or so if you're purchasing plants through in either an online retailer or through a local nursery. On the other hand, you can also go on a much higher level and set up very large enclosures that may have functional doors, actual climate control, and get into growing some of the more rare miniature orchid species and other unusual plants that, you know, you could be looking at easily spending several hundreds of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that I think can appeal to everybody, no matter what their budget really is.
Mm-hmm. So terrariums aren't just for plants, they're also for little critters, amphibians. You all sell dart frogs, the poison dart frog. But like, could I just go out in the backyard and catch one of my little toads and stick them in my terrarium and, you know, expect them to live? Or are there certain amphibians that are just better suited to that sort of contained terrarium lifestyle?
Well, surprisingly, the tropical species of amphibians are the ones that are actually much more suited for terrarium keeping than the temperate species, ones that we would find in most of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The main reason being is the terrarium, just by nature, is very stable, whereas the most of the climate in the U.S., as we all know, is anything but, especially nowadays.
Right.
And the plants and animals that are native here are adapted to living with those changes and actually need them.
Okay. That makes sense, of course. It's like if you're used to living in the tropics or not used to living in the tropics, and then I stick you into a terrarium, it may be sort of hard to adjust.
Exactly, and especially with the complex life cycles of hibernation, and you know, from a human perspective, we may look at the poor little animals cold and frozen over the winter, but
they need
That's what they need.
Yeah, so. So, okay, let's talk about the poison dart frog. Is it the frog poisonous, or is it the frog that they use to make poison darts out of?
Well, the frogs themselves, in nature, actually produce a toxin that's released through the skin.
Okay.
There's probably only about three species that, number one, are used actually by the local natives for the toxin.
Mm-hmm.
Out of those species, one, the Phyllobates terribilis, or the terrible dart frog, is the one that's most commonly used.
Yeah. Okay.
How they get the name dart frog is not as, believe it or not, some people may think they don't shoot darts out of their tongue or anything like that, but the native Chaco Indians will collect the frogs and then roll their blow darts across the back of the frog
and make a poison
and
dart.
That picks up the toxins and then they utilize that for hunting.
So the ones that you have for sale that I would put in a terrarium, are they going to have a bunch of poison all over their skin too? Like, do you need to
not
be careful?
Actually, they are perfectly harmless.
Okay, so it's just
in
a different
captivity,
species.
They're not eating the same things in the wild that that allow them to manufacture that toxin.
Okay. Are there other amphibians that are good to keep in the terrarium?
Several other animals actually do work out well in the terrariums. You really, again, just need to kind of tailor the conditions and the plant selections to match their needs. But other smaller species of tree frog can work out well. Even smaller species of reptile, things like smaller lizards such as the green anoles or some of the little amoebas and swifts, and even some of the smaller species of snake, like the little rough green snake or smooth green snake. Really, the main limiting factor is the amount of waste that the animal puts out.
Okay.
Because even in the terrariums where you have the animals in there, it's not something that you ever really break down and clean per se.
Mm-hmm.
It does actually become a very dynamic system where the waste of the animals is completely broken down by the plants in there.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to ship animals and plants around the country?
We do. We actually ship plants year-round. We also ship frogs year-round. We do have a little bit more restrictions as far as temperature goes on that. During the winter, which up here in Massachusetts actually pretty much started today, will last almost 6 months of the year.
Cute.
So we do have to use insulated boxes and heat packs to do so safely. But we do ship everything year-round.
All right. Bob, I think I know what I'm going to get you for Christmas this year.
A poison frog?
A poison dark frog for your sunroom.
I can hardly wait.
Richard, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, guys. It was great.
Uh-huh. Richard Rivas co-owns Black Jungle Terrarium Supply Company with Michael Walidis. They are located in Turner Falls, Massachusetts. You'll find everything you need to set up a natural terrarium complete with orchids, ferns, and maybe a poison dart frog. For more information on Richard Rivas and Black Jungle Terrarium Supply, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
I can go and tell my secrets to in my room. In my room, in my room. In this world.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
Question, Miss Wishy.
Mm-hmm.
From a lady named Shelley.
All right.
I sure hope you can help me. About 2 or 3 years ago, my husband and I got an unwelcome visitor that has come to visit us every spring, summer, and fall. It's the box elder bug.
Uh-oh.
Yep. These little pests I know do not cause any real damage to your home, but they're very annoying. I'm hoping you can tell me how to get rid of them once and for all. And also, they have a tree in the front yard called the helicopter tree. I'm not sure the real name. Is there any real connection between these two things? And what can she do about a box elder bug?
I remember calling maples helicopter trees when I was little. So
yeah.
It makes a lot of sense. It is the box elder bug. She's located that or, you know, determined that. And that's pretty easy to determine because they're red and black. Very distinctive looking, don't you think?
Yeah, and they're box shaped.
Yeah, they are. Kind of angular and
right.
Geometrical somehow. They are bugs that seek out the box elder tree. The box elder tree is a maple. It's Acer nigunda,
right.
Or nigundo. The helicopter tree, also a maple. Most maples have the little whirligigs that, you know, look like helicopters the seeds as they drop. The box elder bug will also feed on other species of maples, not just the box elder. They feed on leaves, twigs, all kinds of stuff. They have, you know, sucking mouth parts. So whatever they can suck out of your maple, they will do.
How does she get rid of these things?
So what they're doing now, they've been feeding on these trees in your neighborhood, and now they are coming, trying to look for some sort of winter protection.
Oh.
She did also note that there were several trees that were taken down on her street because of the windstorm earlier from Hurricane Ike. And the fact that those trees have been removed, they could have had overwintering sites in decaying. Here's the thing. You talked about it, Bob. The trees that fell were trees that should have fell because they were decaying on the inside.
Right.
Those are places where box elder bugs and other things would overwinter for protection. So they could potentially be worse because those sources have been eliminated. So they're just coming around your house because they're looking for a place to hang out. Control-wise, sweep them up, sweep them out, you know, try to smash them, whatever. Or you can use insecticidal soap, but it has to be on contact for the box elder bug if you want to kill them. Another suggestion, next year, during the spring and summer and fall, look to see if you can find the actual source of the box elder bug while it's feeding on the tree before it comes to your house.
Okay.
And then you can use some insecticidal soap.
But if you got like a 30-foot tree?
Well, if it's so bad and you can't deal,
chainsaw.
You can cut it down.
Yep.
Or get somebody else to come in and try to treat it with something.
Yeah,
but it's just, it's box elder bug
it's
season.
It's not easy.
It's not easy
with.
Being
no.
green
or
red and black
elder, yeah.
or box elder bug.
Yeah.
So there you go. There you go, Shelley. Sorry, it's probably not the answer that you want to hear, but it's the reality
it's
of
the
box elder bug. It's
yeah.
the truth.
If you have a boxy question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
We've been talking about great greenery inside for most of the show.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great winter greenery on the outside. Guess what it is?
Arum.
You knew it. I love arum. I've got it right outside my side door for mm-hmm. the very reason that it's green all winter.
We had some work done, some basement leaky work done.
I remember that, yeah.
And some of our arum was in the area that got kind of trampled on and dug up on. And guess what's starting to come up?
Your arum.
The arum.
And for listeners who don't have it, and everybody should have this in the winter, it's a little leafy plant. It gets about 8, 10, 12 inches tall. It's got some kind of got spotted leaves sometimes, mm-hmm. kind of marbled leaves. It's kind of a shiny
yeah.
green. And then it dies down in the spring, and up pops this phallic-looking thing
mm-hmm.
with bright orange-red berries on it, which are poisonous. But it's such a great winter plant because it's out there all winter for you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the ones we have are Arum italicum, which comes from, of course, Italy, I would suppose, and Arum maculatum, which means spotted or some
uh-huh.
combination. So
yeah.
we have the maculatum, I think. But if listeners haven't seen the bloom, it's kind of like a jack in the pulpit. It's got this erect finger-like spadix, they call
mm-hmm.
it, with a creamy white flower. Then there's this light green spathe,
mm-hmm.
which covers the spadix like a hood. So it's there, and then it all goes away. And in the summertime, there's nothing there. I plant annuals over it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, bam, back it comes in the winter.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. The word arum comes from the Greek word aron, which means hot or bitter tasting. And it's part of the Araceae family, which is a monster. It's 107 genera, 3,700 species, including Calocasia, Caladium, Taro, Philodendra, and calla lilies, of all things. So
mm-hmm.
it's a real mix. The opposite end of the spectrum, of course, and you know about this one, is the Titan arum, or the Amorphophallus titanum.
Mm-hmm.
which is loosely translates to giant penis.
Yeah.
for better or for worse. It comes from Sumatra. It's known as the corpse flower, offers the world's largest unbranched inflorescence.
Because it stinks, too.
Yeah, it gets mm-hmm. about, the inflorescence itself gets about 10 feet tall. The
mm-hmm.
plant can be 20 feet tall. Smells like stinking, rotten, dead meat. Which, of course, that's the magnet for certain bugs.
Flies love
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Flies love you.
So the Amorphophallus titanum is in the same family as the calla lily. It's just kind of strange. Here's some more interesting arum facts. Although the berries are poisonous, the roots were cooked for food during the Irish potato famine.
Mm-hmm.
Roots were used to make Elizabethan lace. And farmers judged their crops for the season by the size of the spadix in the spring. It was an old farmer's tale.
Mm-hmm.
Size matters. You know, the taller the spadix, the better the crop.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, it gives off heat to draw in bugs and protect itself on cold days.
Huh.
I didn't know that either.
That's how it gets through the winter.
Yeah.
How about that?
Comes with a poem.
Cool.
What more could Bob possibly tell us of that big stinky plant, Amorphophallus, or its cousin, the dainty maculatum, whose fragrance lingers not ad nauseum? Its family has spread from Sumatra to Europe to Louisville to Ghana. Its roots have been used to make lace and porridge the Irish embraced, allowed farmers to gauge their yields without going close to their fields, a plant that gives off some heat and smells like dead rotting meat, and even though it seems sort of silly, also gives us the sweet calla lily. No, none of that matters at all after summer stretches to fall, and we have the arum to prize, never thinking a bit of its size, but more of its January sheen as it thrives just outside, oh so green.
Very nice. And it's a fabulous plant.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Arums.
All right. That ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, we're going to meet some ladies that are part of Garden Rant.
This show is produced by that homegrown green machine, Brad Yost, in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.